Performers includes the boy with tape on his face, who's a mime artist, beardy man, and a bunch of puppets called the Mongrels. You know you're not in for an average evening at the BBC Proms. You join me here at the Royal Albert Hall for the first ever comedy prom. And in a moment, I'll be handing over to our master of ceremonies, the unpredictable Tim Minchin, a kind of Antipodean Bill Bailey. He wears DJ, or at least black waistcoat and white shirt with black jeans and no shoes. Special guests include Susan Bullock, bringing a touch of decorum to the proceedings, together with Kit and the Widow, pianist Danny Driver, and Sue Perkins, who'll be producing punchlines as well as brandishing her baton on the conductor's podium. She'll also be demonstrating her vocal talents too. And in part two, when she's otherwise engaged, Andrew Lytton takes a turn at conducting the BBC Concert Orchestra, and for the rest of the musical numbers, Jules Buckley is the MD. The orchestra's usual lineup is supplemented by a rhythm section, as the music ranges from classical comedy such as Reisenstein's Concerto Popolare to comedy classics, including the Hippopotamus Song, made gloriously famous by Flanders and Swann. Prepare for a good giggle. Orchestrations, lyrics, and other minor details were still being sorted out as late as this afternoon, so improvisation is very much a part of this event. Really, anything could happen. There are screens all around the hall, projecting close-ups of the soloists, bringing a touch of the O2 Arena to the Royal Albert Hall. And onto the stage now comes our MD, Jules Buckley, shaking hands with leader Cynthia Fleming. There's rather one rather grumpy face, actually, just below me. A bearded critic, seems to be a bit unsettled.
I sit here as for 20 years I've sat, wearing my music critic's hat. I mean, it's clearly not an actual hat, it's metaphorical. And in those 20 years I'm sad to say these wondrous promenades have gone from bad to worse to bad to pretty crap to bloody horrible. I admit I'm a bit of a classical music boffin, and although I've said this often, the final nail in the coffin of these proms is surely imminent. Yes, we survived Nigel effing Kennedy, but surely there's no earthly remedy for a night of so-called comedy hosted by an immigrant. Why we insist on this tosh, it's a mystery. Art and craft are an album history. 50 years of history tossed away for a cheap guffaw. One of our nation's finest traditions, some of our country's finest musicians, forced into humiliating positions, is nothing sacred anymore. Classical music should always be performed, well, you know, classically, with suitably solemn solemnity, and usually in 3-4-2-3-1-2-3. Now we have this comedy prom. It's all boom-tish and pom-pom-pom. What are these BBC idiots on? Is nothing sacred anymore? I remember it seems like yesterday, watching the greats who'd come to play. It was so magical and gay, back when gay meant something good. I wish that I were back there once again, when the orchestras were made of men, and some patience and a penny could give you Henry Wood, you would get wood. Oh, what Henry Wood would think, if only Henry Wood could think. Though he's extinct, he would have died if he had seen this. Endless rhymes and dirty puns, people drumming with their tongues. They think it's funny, forcing divas to sing penis. I I remember it seems like yesterday, when conductors were bearded and grey. This little twerp is not yet shaving, or even looking at the score. Is nothing sacred anymore? We used to care about the art. I mean, honestly, look at this violinist chart. It actually says fart. Is nothing sacred anymore? Redemption and the Lord, heaven's glory and hell's fires, the battle of the light against the dark, the timeless narratives that drove Mozart and boring Bach. We no longer give a fuck, 'cause nothing's sacred, praise the Lord. Something designed for us comic musicians. We'll do it every year at the comedy prom. It'll be a ritual from now on. At the end of the night, right, listen up, before they kick us out, start packing up. I reckon all you peasants in the cheap seats should take off your clothes and ride naked on the floor, while a member of the royal family plays the tune to Doctor Who on a guitar. Yeah. Seemed reasonable at the time. Welcome to the planet's first comedy prom. Go insane. That was interesting. Something new. So, as I'm sure you all know, the word prom is a shortening of the word promenade, which is a type of drink, like lemonade, but instead of lemons, it's made of promy granites. The promy granite, as you know, of course, is a fruit, the flesh of which is the same color as your liver, because it's named after the Greek myth of Prometheus, who was punished by Zeus for stealing fire, and his punishment was to be tied to a rock for eternity. That's where the granite comes from, in Promigranate. And the eagles were sent down to peck out his liver, therefore Promigranate, and the drink promenade, which Henry Wood loved. I mean, you could ask him, but he loved promenade, and thought it was very nice and fizzy, and therefore he named his series of classical concerts after. Tonight you are going to see a classical pianist, an opera singer, some puppets, a beatboxer, a rapper, and a mime artist, especially for the Radio 3 listeners at home. And me, Tim Minchin, who's been engaged on the promise that I won't... thanks. A few people just realised it was me. I've been engaged on the promise that I won't swear or talk about Jesus or mention the riots. Damn. Because this is a promenade and we want to keep it fizzy. Your first guest tonight was, in the early parts of this century, a successful rapper. He played with people like Mark Ronson, Lily Allen, and the late Amy Winehouse. In 2008, he turned his hand to comedy, and he now plays with the likes of me. Interesting career move. Please welcome the absolutely lovely and hilariously funny Doc Brown.
Yeah. Okay. Oh. Wow. This is a special moment for me, man. You know, I always dreamed of being like the most famous British rapper since like John Barnes, and now like with this gig, I felt could be tricky, you know, because a lot of people, they really hate rap, you know. But I'm used to that. I'm used to a bit of animosity, you know. I've been to Kent, so you know, I was thinking like, what should I rap about in this situation? What should I rap about? You know, politics maybe? Nah, you know, I'm way too much of a fence sitter when it comes to politics. You know me, I'd be like, oh, forget Nick Clegg, he's a wannabe. However, I do agree with some of his policies, which is, you know, that's no good. You know, street crime, I can't really get into that. You know, I've never been a criminal of any kind, never been to prison. You know, and I've never was one of those kids either who would forcibly do jail time just to beef up my street creds. You know, I don't think I could maintain the hard facade. In fact, even just using words like facade would probably probably blow my cover relatively early. So I figured, look, it's the Royal Albert Hall. I'm at the Proms. It doesn't get any more British than that, right? So I figured I will rap about a British institution, okay? Because I figured, you know, look, I'm living my dream right now. That's how I really feel. I'm living the dream, and I want to share my dreams with you. Okay? Because everybody's got a fantasy, a mad scheme, a crazy plan, a dream that we could make reality. Maybe my plan's sad, but since I was a lad, I wish David Attenborough was my granddad. You look at me like, this man's mad, get a CAT scan, you're one horn short of a jazz band. Yeah, it may seem strange for a rap fan to wish for Attenborough's voice on my sat-nav. He'd be my guide, I'd be Robin to his Batman. I'd help him research wolf cubs in Lapland. You know, I'd be like, granddad, I saw another one. He'd give me a hand clap, cause that man's a living legend. The best yet, he was flipping old when I was little, still isn't dead yet. And when he pops his clogs, I'll be crestfallen. He never sat me on his knee for a bed story. Wish I could just put him on as a very special vocal guest on my song. I'd have him do a little cameo feature saying, Doc Brown's an incredible creature. Yeah, imagine that. Of all my crew, I wish Attenborough had my back. And we could spend a beautiful future together. He could dumb it down for me, I could get clever. Tell him all about rap and girls. He could tell me all the facts of the world. But what's the chances he'd be listening to some little rap? He probably thinks it's all bitches and stuff. But Dave is so much more. I aspire to have lyrics like yours. I'd love to rap about panthers that ran fast. Damn, I wish Attenborough was my grandpa. Yeah, I wish Attenborough was my grandpa. Oh, damn, I wish Attenborough was my grandpa. You can but dream, you can but dream. 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 Thank you. Thank you. Now, I know a lot of you think I might have been joking. Some of you may have felt that you just witnessed the man having a mini breakdown. So, but no, I'm serious. I mean, forget rappers. Attenborough, to me, is the greatest living lyricist there is. You know why? Because anything that he narrates, for me, I feel like I can relate to it. You know, I don't know if you've seen any of these shows, but if you have, then you'll know what I mean, right? Alone. Alone. The giant Pacific octopus scours the seabed in search of the perfect den. It must be perfect, for it's going to be her home for the next 6 months. She's carrying fertilized eggs. And now, happy and settled, she lays them. 100,000 of them. Over the next 6 months, she carefully tends to her brood, never leaving the den for a moment. Thus, unable to leave, she is starving. These young will not reach adulthood, but she's given them the best possible chance
her final act of devotion, gently blowing warm water over the surface of the eggs to encourage them to hatch. And after a long and lonely vigil, she is dead.
Ladies and gentlemen,
honestly, I was sat there looking at that TV screen thinking, man, this geezer knows exactly how it is for single mums.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Doc Brown. No stranger to the Proms, having performed in front of 30,000 people last year on the last night of the Proms in Hyde Park. Give it up one more time for Sue Perkins.
Thank you. There's an old saying, you play the Royal Albert Hall twice in your career, once on the way up and once on the way down. By God, it's good to be back. Hi. And what a way to be back. I've always thought when I play this venue again, I'd like to be in a breastplate, a horned helmet, being manhandled by a Bosnian love god, and forced to sing the word penis in a screeching falsetto. And that, for me, really sums up what Radio 3 is about.
Excuse me, Sue. Sorry, ladies and gentlemen. Hello.
Hello.
I'm
being heckled by a woodland creature.
And not for the first time. I am...
It was one stoat. That was it. It was just one stoat. We had him removed.
But it was in the papers. I am Nilsson the Fox,
right,
from BBC Three's Mongrels.
Oh.
Now, could I just say, Sue Perkins, huge fan.
Oh.
Enormous fan.
Thank you.
I've seen all your work. Where to begin?
Oh, dear.
Just a Minute, QI, Supersizers. Oh, and of course, Maestro, the conducting competition where
you
beat Goldie.
Yep.
That's the rapper, not the Blue Peter dog, who I did actually meet once in a park. He was a bit up himself, literally. Anyway, would you mind awfully signing my tale?
Okay. No idea how wide my demographic was. Was stalked by a badger once. But I don't really want to touch this because I have a sort of no mange clause in my contract, so I'm sort of loathe to touch that.
Right.
Touch it.
Well, I'll be honest, Sue. I am a little hurt by that comment. I mean, you know what? Foxes aren't so different from humans. I mean, let's face it, there were lots of feral creatures running around London this summer, leaving neighbourhoods a complete mess. And for once, it wasn't us. So, by the way,
yeah.
Where do you stand on toxoplasmosis?
But as far away as I can, I imagine, but...
Bang!
Yeah.
I said I'm up, you spike 'em, Sue.
Do
you know what? We aren't so different, you and I, Sue Perkins.
No?
We're both urbane, erudite. We've eaten enormous amounts of chicken.
It's true, I suppose. We both raided bins late at night when we're hungry. We've both been chased across moorland by packs of angry dogs. We've both bitten children now and then.
That's right. Now, Sue, this might seem like a crazy suggestion, but hell, I'll say it anyway. We're at the Royal Albert Hall. We've got a crowd. Would you like to sing a song from the award-winning BBC Three comedy show Mongrel Sue Perkins? Plug, get it round that BBC Two. I think it sums up our audience, sums up the Proms rather perfectly. It's called Middle Class is Magical.
Nilsson, you had me at Fox.
middle class is magical, a safe world free from strife. Then bad things happen to other folk while you read Country Life. Buy an Aga, wear a monsoon dress, get your food from M&S. Own an iPhone, watch Bear Grylls, take antidepressant pills. Middle class is magical, drive a 4x4 to school. Keep three sorts of hummus in your fridge, bake over your downstairs loo. Learn to salsa, ski and Verbier. Drink too much chili and Chardonnay. Ignore the homeless, don't mind burgers. Condescend to migrant workers. When all the world is middle class, there'll be no poverty or starvation. 'Cause we'll all grow our own mange too, and myelin class will rule the nation. Because middle class is magical. Join us and you'll see. You're already halfway there, 'cause you're not watching ITV. Yes, middle class is magical. What matters is what we wear. Let's pay someone else to do the difficult jobs while we work on our hair.
Sue Perkins and her mongrels, now showing on BBC 3.
Come on, come on, we're okay, come on.
This is Jules, he's my private conductor. I just have one just in case something needs to happen in time at any given point in my life. Breakfast, he brings me in to breakfast. So these guys. These guys, ladies and gentlemen. Because I'm a very professional MC and I understand what it is to record a radio program, I spend a lot of time pointing at things and going, oh, look, that. These guys. People at home listening to the radio, you just missed an amazing piece of clearing of stage. To bring a little bit of solemnity back into these promenadian proceedings, I'd like to play you a lullaby that I wrote for the second half of my two children.
Sleep, little baby, sleep now, my love. The Milky Way shining high up above. When you grow up, you will learn all that stuff. But for now, close your eyes. Close your eyes. Sleep, little baby, try not to squawk. Tomorrow and tomorrow, you'll learn how to walk, to love and laugh, to make toast and talk. But for now, Betty buys your blankets hand-knitted with pure Angora wool. Your nappy is dry and your tummy is full of enough antihistamine to chill out a bull. Yet still all this cringing. What more could you want for? I just cannot guess. You constantly complain to me, you should feel blessed. There are children in Africa starving to death, and you don't hear them whinging. What more can I do to put a stop to this mind-numbing noise you are making? Where is the line between patting and hitting? When is rocking rocking, and when is it shaking? I don't know what else I can do to try and hush you. My heart says I love you, but my brain's saying
you and hoping a child trafficker will abduct you. At least then I'll get a few hours in bed. I've shushed and I've cooed and I've even tried to sing oh, blah-dee, in the exact voice of Ringo. Now all I have left is to hope that a dingo will sneak in and rip off your fat bitching head. Buy you a mockingbird in the hope you get avian flu. The nice folk in A&E will take care of you. Close your eyes, shh, not a sound. I can barely see your tiny belly moving up and down. One thing they don't mention in the parenting book, your love for them grows the closer to dead they look.
Maintain and enhance your applause for the indescribably wonderful boy with tape on his face. Doing some mime, and I've brought Doc Brown here to help me commentate, because the BBC thought that the Radio 3 listeners, if they were just sitting at home listening to Chris de Burgh music, might think the programmers had gone doolally.
A bit nuts. What we're seeing here is a
lady boy
in red reincarnation from the lad with tape on his mouth, and it's quite remarkable. He's created a woman out of a coat. He's stroking. Yeah. The hand's gone to her nether regions. Oh, and she's moved it back up again.
yeah, but it's just him. I mean, this is the important thing we need to.
This is not a real woman.
We need
that
to make
being,
sure we understand.
Gropified. He started to undress her from underneath the coat. If you can believe that. And she's willing now. She's willing. And she's gone.
That's it.
She's gone.
So just to clarify, this is the boy with tape on his face is
That's
a mime
correct.
Artist. We won't tell you his real name. I don't
no.
think he has one. And the title, his title is pretty descriptive. He is a young chap with a piece of gaffer tape across his mouth.
And crucially, no facial hair. Okay, and out of the black sack, he's pulled two horses' heads. These are not Godfather heads. They are toy, furry horses' heads.
Yeah, horses.
One in each hand.
And William tells over to you. And here we go. And Sue Perkins has taken over the conducting. Did you notice that? So you have to do more watching,
incredible.
Doc Brown.
I didn't
in the classical music world, you have to be quick or someone changes.
You're right.
So there's some hot horses.
They're literally neck and neck at the moment. I mean, he's wringing both of their necks. Left hand has taken the lead.
It's hard to really describe. There's a man with two horses' heads. It's like Godfather 2.
It kind of looks like he's dusting, but not quite. The horses' heads have gone now.
What's he doing?
Well, up next, he's just adjusting the mic stand. And he is playing the William Tell Overture using hands, claps, and finger snaps.
Which is funny, because I thought there was some sort of miming code that you weren't really allowed to make any noise.
I don't believe you were allowed to make noise, but...
Have you read the miming code?
I haven't.
I've read a miming code. he's got an audience member.
Yeah, he's pulled up. There was another guy who thought it was him from eye contact, and he was wrong, so he sat back down.
This guy looks like a sort of avuncular figure. The bloke he's pulled up on stage has glasses, grey hair, shirt tucked in.
Very sensible side
he's
party.
He's been given two pom-poms, golden pom-poms.
Golden
pom-poms.
He's
been taught to shake them by the boy with the tape on his face.
And... he's gone off. He's gone off into one. The older gentleman. He's starting
to
freestyle.
Now he has a toilet seat around his neck. If you can imagine the bit you sit on if you're sitting around the neck of a conservative gentleman, the lid open flat like the front of a shirt. The lid is open across his stomach and upper nether regions.
And we should stress that this seat is completely clean.
And the boy
unused.
With tape on his face now has a plunger and is throwing it at the seat. Are we making this better or worse for
I
the
really
listeners
don't know,
of radio?
But he
I'm going to take off because I have to go upstairs and be near the organ.
Okay, I'll
so
see if I can break this down.
There's a hint for the Radio 3 listeners.
Cheers to him.
Bye, bye, Doc.
Okay, he's hooded the man in something approaching Guantanamo Bay fashion. And he has a plunger, which he is aiming at his chest where the toilet seat resides. The man looks slightly nervous. Here we go. Oh, it bounced off the toilet seat. Second attempt. It sticks. And that is 1-0 to the boy with tape on his face. The gentleman appears to be happy to be here. A toilet roll has been added to the neck of the plunger. And he's pulled the toilet roll from the man's stomach all the way. So he's stretched the line of TP to the mic stand. And the horses are back. And they're racing towards what looks like a finish line. Centre stage. Here he goes. Left hand. Right hand. Left hand, right hand, left hand, right hand, left hand, right hand, left hand, right hand, left hand. It's a photo finish. The boy with tape on his face. Incredible. Please do make sure you watch this when it airs on BBC Two, because I'm afraid that the last minute and a half for me may have been completely and utterly useless.
I'll get many more opportunities to do that. That's Light My Fire on the Royal Albert Hall organ. That's I think I can tick that off my bucket list. This next duo have been compared in the press to a modern-day Flanders and Swan and have played in virtually every venue in this country, from the comedy proms to the Royal Variety Show. This baritone and his little skinny pianist have been all over the country and are really the kind of act that represent everything a comedy prom should be and would have been if my agent hadn't have slept with the head of Radio 3. Please welcome the beautiful Kit and the Widow.
Oh, that was so close.
Lavatory seats
toilet plungers. I mean, I know the vandals are at the gates, but Henry Wood must be spinning in his grave.
Listen what to that, that hum. We can hear him.
Are we in the right place?
Well, no, are we in the right? Because there should be a fountain somewhere here. There should be a fountain.
Oh, what's happened to the fountain? Well, did it get lost in the looting, probably?
No first down market and now no fountain. Do you think we could help by trying to raise the tone?
Raise the musical bar. This is the Albert Hall, for God's sake. These are the proms.
My plan is we should include some music by the man who is, I think, probably without question, the greatest composer alive in this country.
In this country and Europe and the world.
Intergalactically.
His brother was playing his cello in this.
Oh, yes, some dreary bits of Holst. There was a little bit of that, but that's not the same.
It's not the same. I refer, of course, to Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber, may his tribe increase.
So I beg your pardon. What? He's not Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber. His name is Lord Webber.
Lloyd Webber, yes. I am not worthy.
These things are terribly important.
They are. And since we seem to be chasing the Saturday night ratings, what better than to place...
Well, I think if you could just remember that his name is Lord Lloyd Webber, Baron of Sidmonton, that will help.
Baron of Sidmonton. Yes. Baron. He's styled Baron. Nothing to do with his musical imagination. He's just styled Baron. And in these concerts, I think his place is rightfully here. We shall use his formula now when we shall share with you, good promenaders, tonight. You too can write a great West End score, steal it from somebody else. The public will clamour, the public will roar, they won't know the best tunes were written before. Prod their memories with some musical arrow that sounds quite like Bolero, and sit back as it sells. You too can write a great West End score, steal from somebody else. Young Mendelssohn wrote this lovely violin tune. I don't know, but I love it. I don't see why it moves me. Gold and Trost, Blut und Blut. I bet Richard Strauss couldn't think of that. Open up your mind, let your fantasies unwind. And if Puccini's Fanciulla sounds the same, safer that than rip off La Boheme. You too can write a great West End score, steal it from somebody else. It's very easy, don't think it's strange. All you need is a good piece by Bach, and no one will know once you've made the odd change. It's an illusion. It's not as original as they all claim. It's the prelude in C all the time. But the royalties still stay the same. Vol tempered clavier fugue in E major, sung high by Michael Ball. Love changes. Bugger all! Don't, Lloyd Webber said one day, Ray, that show about the nun. Me, I wish I penned myself, far outclasses all I've done. So I'll hog the screen for weeks. I'll allure the best tunes from the show. TV viewers will think it's mine, and I'll make a stack of dough.
That's better. That's better. Yeah. Now,
Some proper music.
Yes.
You see, I think it was last year that the rot set in with all this showbiz light stuff at the
Well, I think there was a birthday celebration with a whole giddy evening of it.
80th birthday celebration of some music writer.
I think they're getting the drift here.
I think it was thrown out as a sop. As a piece of raw meat to, as I say, the vandals baying at the gates.
Do you know, I think in this section I can smell one or two of them.
His followers?
Yeah.
Oh, they're very keen, very worrying. People who like Sondheim always keep their buttocks clenched tight. Never ever miss a first night. Memorize his shows. People who like Sondheim sit and seethe an impotent rage, saying he's ahead of his age. That's why no one goes. Religiously they learn all those eternal and infernal internal rhymes, though they're quite mechanical, chanting them litanically hundreds of times. And oh, what a shame that the moment you feel that the tune might begin, people who like Sondheim love him with a frenzy. No one's good as he is, but who they want to be is Julia Mackenzie. So many mornings with so many workmen in so many wonderful towns, whistling those fabulous hit songs like cha-cha-cha-cha. People who like Sondheim, people Sondheim's theater, knife-wielding psychotics, terminal neurotics, people of the theater. The world loves its barbarized, synthesized burger and ketchup noise. You start off with art and end up with, God help us, the Pet Shop Boys. Stick Lloyd Webber's head on a spike, better be like people who like Sondheim. No more big band endings. Let the music fade out, vanish up its bottom. People who like something. There's trouble.
Excuse me.
Trouble in the mosh pit.
Sorry,
there is a disturbance. Security.
Sorry,
we have trouble.
Excuse me, Mr. Hesketh Harvey. I need to have a word with you.
What?
Do you realize who this is?
What? Look. It's Bullock.
It's the Bullock.
There's a rogue Bullock.
Do we have
a matador in the house, ladies and gentlemen?
Darling.
The leading Wagnerian soprano of her generation. What are you doing down there?
Never mind all that. I need to have a very strict word with you two.
Why?
Because I can't stand the way you're talking about Stephen Sondheim. How dare you?
So I cannot concentrate when you're dressed like that. Excuse me. What is this?
Trousers.
Trousers at the Albert Hall. Darling, the thing is, you're a soprano.
And?
I mean, you're dressed like a mezzo.
Excuse me. Excuse me. Do I look like the sort of girl who's about to break into a da capo aria?
Let's only hope not.
Now look.
Can I just say, aren't you 4 weeks early?
Well, yes, I'm just getting a bit of practice.
She's doing the last night, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
This is it.
Exciting.
Yes.
Oh, look.
Yes.
Ooh, oh.
But meanwhile, I've got the most marvellous Sondheim song here, and I think we should do it.
A Sondheim song to do
saying.
Now?
Absolutely.
Oh,
which
I can't
one?
Wait.
Which one?
Oh, this one.
Oh, how. Oh, look. Susan Bullock. It's the boy from. Oh.
Marvellous piece.
What? Yeah, now, look, you see. Do you see where it says there at the top? Words by Stephen Sondheim.
Yes.
Tune by Mary Rogers.
Oh.
Stole it from somebody else.
Yes. You see? It's not by Sondheim at all.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Can we do it anyway?
I think that's why you might like it. Just a guess.
Ladies and gentlemen, the leading Wagnerian soprano of her generation will now deliver, by Stephen Sondheim and Mary Rogers, The Boy From.
Don't tall and slender like an Apollo. He goes walking by and I have to follow him. The boy from Tacarembo, La Tumbe del Fuego, Santa Malipa, Zacatecas, La Junta del Sol y Cruz. When we meet, I feel I'm on fire and I'm breathless. Every time I inquire, how are things in Tacarembo, La Tumbe del Fuego, Santa Malipa, Zacatecas, La Junta del Sol y Cruz? Why, when I speak, does he vanish? Ooh, why is he acting so clannish? Wish I understood Spanish. When I tell him I think he's the end, he giggles a lot with his friend. Tall and slender, moves like a dancer, but I never get to get any answer from the boy from Tacarembo, La Tumbe del Fuego, Santa Malipa, Zacatecas, La Junta del Sol y Cruz. I've got the blues. His trousers vermilion. His trousers are vermilion. Why does he claim he's Castilian? He says he's Castilian. Why do his friends call him Lillian? And I hear at the end of the week he's leaving to start a boutique. Though I smile, I'm only pretending, 'cause I know today's the last I'll be spending with the boy from Tacarembo, La Tumbe del Fuego, Santa Malipa, Zacatecas, La Junta del Sol y Cruz. Tomorrow he sails, he's moving to Wales to live in Llanfair, Pwllgwyn, Gillgo, Gerll, Gwyndro, Bwyll, Llandysilio, Go, Go, Goff. Oh.
Squeegees and dismembered brollies, Coca-Cola cans and rusting shopping trolleys, several discarded single Black Doc Martins, hordes and hordes and hordes of old McDonald's cartons, half a Fiat 126 to claim the insurance, prophylactics way beyond mankind's endurance, Tesco bags and bits of orange nylon rope, and look, there are bottles labelled Cherryade and Rocket Thunder, empty packs of cigarettes and Golden Wonder, toys that you get given free at service stations, plastic fobs from Henley members' reservations, orange peel and Castrol Super Lube containers, Baco Foil and Adidas athletic trainers, double blade disposable blue razor blades, and look, there are heart disintegrating bits of perch and tension, floating recent life that won't bear close attention, shiny pools of manganese and benzo chloride, sulfurous waves of petrofluoride, sewage treated and untreated in profusion, drainings from an engine sump in part solution, old car batteries sitting on the glorious placid shoreline, leaking acid, and washed down from lovely shimmering Derwent water, one whole sheep marked radioactive, do not slaughter, canisters with skull and crossbones part revealed, canisters unmarked just saying Sellafield, banks of vegetation standing rotting sweetly, banks where vegetation's given up completely. There I sat down, and I saw a swan of purest whiteness gently lying, saw a swan of purest whiteness slowly dying, saw a swan enmeshed in bits of angler's twine, poisoned by the lead weights on a fishing line, and many people rushing forward who cried to see it, many people rushing forward who tried to free it, saw the swan who lifted up her fading head, saw them gasp to hear her as she quietly said, you'll no doubt have heard how swans refrain from crying up until the moment that we find we're dying. Charming, but as you can see, by then it's not much use. Quite apart from which, swans aren't responsible, you know. So, what's your excuse?
They need a drink.
They definitely need a drink.
They need a drink. They need a drink.
I've never seen Cynthia so parched. Look,
exactly, look,
gagging for it.
Desperate
to drink.
For
yes.
gin, these people.
Shall we
go towards the interval, shall we?
So, I think so, yes.
But do you think we ought to do the sing-along now?
Well, because quite a lot of these people will go home at the interval, obviously.
I think they will, yes. So
shall we do it now in case they want to slip away?
It's very very promenade-y, of course, to have a sing-along. And no down-market concert is complete without the Nessendorma from Turandot, ladies
lovely.
And gentlemen. So we thought
I felt a stiffening in the hall. I
think,
did.
Yes, they're very excited.
Yeah, lovely.
It's a sing-along number, isn't it?
Well, it's karaoke, really.
Karaoke, yes. But because it's Saturday evening and it's something you can take away with you, we thought we'd think of it as curry-oaky, if that's all right.
Very good. Curry-oaky.
Very good. You see what I did there? Yeah, we're not going to do it in Italian. Good. We're going to do it in Punjabi this evening.
Oh, and terrific.
The lovely, lovely Miss Bullock will be here to take your orders. She's got the words written out for you.
Terrific.
I'll do the rather trickier verses. You do the choruses, and then you can all go and have your drinks, if that's all right. But, ladies and gentlemen, clear your pharynxes, lube your larynxes, get ready, as together at the Albert Hall Comedy Prom, we sing Puccini in Punjabi. Chicken korma, chicken korma, maligatoni puri, masala tandoori, rogan raita, peshwari naan patia, and stuffed paratha. Over to you, boys and girls. Useful baritone, haven't you?
That's wonderful. Thank you. I try my best.
Samosa! Sag pasana, onion bhaji, meat biryani. One last time, boys and girls.
Pino!
Well, it beats Land of Hope and Glory, Kit and the Widow, with the able assistance of Susan Bullock and the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall, ending the first half of our comedy prom with a karaoke, perfect for a Saturday night. When I spoke to Kit Hesketh-Harvey a couple of days ago, he told me, seasoned performer that he is, he was terrified at the thought of performing here, but also thrilled at the prospect and certainly enjoying it. And this, the first ever BBC comedy prom, that cheer you just heard, for the BBC Concert Orchestra. Well, there'll be much more musical comedy in part two. This event hosted on stage by Australian comedian Tim Minchin. He didn't keep his grumpy critic disguise for long, ripping off his velcroed suit and his grey wig to sit down at the piano with his trademark ginger dreadlocks. More about that a little later on. Well, Tim, the man largely responsible for dragging musical comedy into this postmodern era, and I particularly hoped you enjoyed the mime act, The Boy with Tape on His Face, with the fabulous commentary from Doc Brown and Tim Minchin. They could have future careers as audio describers. Well, Sue Perkins was taking her turn to conduct the BBC Concert Orchestra. Andrew Lytton will have a go after the interval, but first, time to join Matthew Sweet for tonight's Proms Plus literary event, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, just across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Hello. Tonight is the first ever comedy prom, unless you count that Malcolm Arnold piece with all the vacuum cleaners. So that makes this the first ever comedy proms plus literary event, or at least the first one where the participants will actually try to be funny. And tonight we'll succeed or we'll die in the attempt. We're here at the Royal College of Music, but we've had the audience specially sent down from the Glasgow Empire, just as a bit of a challenge for my two guests tonight, who are Natalie Haynes, classicist, comic, critic, and columnist, and Steve Punt, a graduate of that terribly cool 90s comedy collective, The Merry Whitehouse Experience. And he's still terribly cool, even though his programme, The Now Show, goes out after Moneybox. Tonight, Natalie and Steve are going to be performing some of their favourite pieces of comic literature, and then they'll be intellectualising about them. So wish them luck and give them a big hand. Natalie, I've already mentioned your training in the classics. How can something written several thousand years ago be funny?
Well, I think in a way it sort of depends on the kind of jokes that they are. So I would argue that if you haven't seen One Man, Two Governors, which is at the National and then going on tour and then going to the West End, you should. It may be a Commedia dell'arte play, but they've translated it to 60s Brighton. It works incredibly well. It feels very contemporary. It feels very funny. I think Juvenal is my favourite Roman writer because he writes what we tend to call them satires, but actually they are scurri, rants. So he is basically a stand-up. You would pay for Juvenal to turn up in a hall and tell you why Rome was awful in a funny way. Aristophanes was the first comic playwright. He's the great comic innovator, and he has everything. It's like The Simpsons. You've got sight gags, you've got puns, you've got people falling over, you've got double entendre, you have ridiculous fantasy. So he throws everything at it, and like Austin Powers, if it doesn't all work for you, that's all right. But the amount of it that does will make it the funniest thing you've seen.
But the machinery of humour, essentially,
hasn't changed at all. No, you still use the exact same techniques. Comedians use techniques that ancient orators would have used. When an orator lists three things, the good, the bad, the ugly, he calls it a tricolon. A comedian calls it a rule of three.
Steve, I can remember a routine that you did on the Merry Whitehouse Experience, all about how Elizabethan humour wasn't funny anymore. I believe it. I'm sure it contained you saying the phrase, pox ont, or I take you for a Rhenish knave.
Yes, it did. But I would defend that in a sort of Spinal Tap kind of way, in the sense that it's a great misapprehension about comedy to think that it's all about sneering at things and belittling things. Actually, very often, I think humour comes from an enormous affection for something. And people tend to write their best jokes about things they care about, I think. There's a lot of caring in good comedy.
But a lot of comedy does have a kind of inbuilt ephemerality to it, because it's about whatever's going on in the moment of its production.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. I mean, you will certainly find in Shakespeare or any play of that era that there is a lot of vocabulary and a lot of references that a modern audience simply aren't going to get. And there's no point pretending you do. And the only solution really would be to have the notes from the Arden edition scrolling on a huge screen down the side of the stage in the way that they do at the opera. But the point is, and the point of that piece with people saying, you know, fire upon you for a Manning tree ox, Sirrah, was that it doesn't matter. It actually doesn't really matter because it's not... it shouldn't affect your enjoyment of the structures and the characters, those sort of timeless things. You shouldn't be put off any kind of humour from any era by trivialities about a particular word you don't understand. It doesn't really matter.
So, Natalie, are the rhythms of the piece more important than the particularity of the meaning of the exact meaning of what's being
yes,
said?
Yes, absolutely. It doesn't. It really doesn't matter. You can take the same joke and make it about different politicians. I will guarantee you there are stand-ups in Edinburgh this very month doing jokes about, for example, the riots earlier this week that they would have done last time there were riots. There will be people doing jokes about... the sexuality of a politician that they have most certainly used before.
There is a line...
on a different politician. It doesn't make any difference. The joke is still the same.
There's a line in King Lear which I have never heard not get a laugh from a modern audience, where Lear says, so they're talking about Gloucester, and he says, get thee glass eyes, or like a scurvy politician, seem to see the things thou dost not. And it's, you know, it's still... a relevant and funny joke, I think, today.
OK, well, let's do a bit of show and tell here to prove the point. Natalie, you brought something from The Frogs by Aristophanes for us. Tell us about the piece, and then we are then going to attempt to perform this.
This is Aristophanes' Frogs, which is the first, I think, comic parody ever written. He decides that the god Dionysus should go down into hell and pick a tragedian who has recently died. He decides he needs to go down to the underworld and let them compete for who should be the best person to come back and save the city, because this is 405 BC. The Peloponnesian War has been dragging on since 431. Athens is incredibly depleted. They're in a terrible state. And Aristophanes has this, I think, very sincere belief that a good poet, a good tragedian, can change the course of the city. The version we will do was translated for the Penguin Classics series by David Barrett.
But who are we? I still don't know my motivation.
Right, Ben. I will be the god Dionysus. Steve will be the demigod Hercules, if you're more of a Latin fan. And you will be my slave, Xanthius. I think I've cast it quite well. I should also say there'll be a reference to a man called Cleisthenes. Cleisthenes, for the purposes of this and all other Aristophanes, is a man whose politics Aristophanes doesn't like, and therefore he mocks his sexuality. Well, it's like this, you see. I was on Cleisthenes' ship.
Saw a good bit of action, I expect, one way or the other.
Oh, yeah. We sank 12 enemy ships. Or was it 13?
What, just the two of you?
Yes, by Apollo.
And then I woke up.
Well, as I was saying, I was on the ship, and one day, I was reading the Andromeda at the time. Do you know, I suddenly felt the most passionate longing. You can't imagine how I longed.
For a woman?
Not a bit of it.
A boy?
Uh-uh.
A man, then?
Oh, come, really?
You did say Cleisthenes was a friend of yours.
Don't laugh at me, old man. This is deadly serious. I'm in a terrible state. Consumed with desire.
Yes, but what sort of desire, my dear fellow?
Oh, you wouldn't understand. Let me put it this way. Have you ever felt a sudden craving for, let's say, pea soup?
Ah, now you're talking. When do I not have a craving for pea soup?
Are you with me, or would you care for another illustration?
No, pea soup will do nicely. I understand perfectly.
Well... that is the kind of desire that I feel for Euripides.
But he's a corpse. I mean to say.
No one on earth can stop me from going to seek him out.
What, down to Hades?
And deeper still, if need be.
With what object, may I ask?
I need a poet who can write. There are only two kinds of poet nowadays, the slick and the dead.
Oh, come, what about Sophocles' son? Young Iophon?
He's the only one left that's any good. And even then, I'm not sure.
Why not fetch back Sophocles, if you must have one of them back? He was much better than Euripides.
No, not till I've seen how Iophon manages without his father to help him. Besides, Euripides will be much readier to sneak away with me. He's a much more slippery customer. Whereas Sophocles, well, he always took life as it came. He's probably taking death as it comes, too.
Thank you, Natalie. So what does that tell us about the history of comedy and the endurance of these structures that we've been talking about?
Well, I like the fact that a good old-fashioned necrophilia joke will still get a laugh. Nearly 2,500 years later. It's nice to see that the things which look like they're quite risque are not a modern invention by a long chalk. Every time somebody talks about how taboo comedy is now, you go, not so much.
And does any of this humour sound familiar to you, Steve? I mean, this is essentially satire, isn't it?
Yes, and it's talking about, celebrities of their time. And their public image, and it does feel familiar.
You also get a sense of performance here, don't you? Because of these topical jokes, you can sense how they might have been ringing in a particular audience in the way that a stand-up works now.
Yes, and it's strange because it feels much more human and accessible than you think of Greek plays as being. Because you think of people in masks and this terribly sort of declaimed and very formal. Tragedy, you think of, because the tragedies, for some reason, are much more performed now than the comedies are, because they rely on these references that people don't get. But it is, of course, very directly influential as well, because there was a very long sort of 1,200-year gap where, mostly due to the church, there were no plays. So actually, these plays and the Roman plays, Seneca and Plautus, were very directly influential on Elizabethan theatre and, on therefore, on British theatre.
OK, well, let's move into the Elizabethan era, shall we, Steve? You've chosen some Shakespeare. Let's hear you do something from Henry IV, Part 1.
Yes, OK. Right. that didn't really work on radio. I just moved about 3 yards.
You
to
moved
the left.
Beautifully,
yeah,
though.
Yeah,
he sprang like a gazelle.
Sprang like a cat across the stage. This is a tavern scene from Henry IV, Part 1. What's happened is that Falstaff has been misleading or leading astray Prince Hal, who is the son of the king. But while he's not the king yet, he's just sort of lying about in a tavern with these dissolute people.
That's us.
These are the dissolute people over here. And they've been engaged in a bit of highway robbery, which they've cooked up. But of course, because he's the prince, Prince Hal and his, Natalie, and his friend Poins, who's Matthew, have actually not gone along with this. They pretended they were going to, but Falstaff and his gang, as soon as they'd robbed the money from the coach, were immediately jumped on by these two. There's only two of them. And they promptly stole the money back. And then they all headed home in the dark, and now they're back at the tavern where they're all trying to work out what happened, and Falstaff is about to explain it from his point of view.
What? Fought you with them all?
All? I know not what you call all, but if I fought not with 50 of them, I am a bunch of radish. If there were not 2 and 3 and 50 upon poor old Jack, then I am no two-legged creature.
Pray God you have not murdered some of them.
Nay, that's past praying for. I've peppered 2 of them. 2 I am sure I have paid. 2 rogues in buckram suits. I tell you what, Hal, if I tell thee a lie, spit in my face, call me hoarse. Thou knowest my old ward. Here I lay, and thus I bore my point. 4 rogues in buckram let drive at me.
What, 4? Thou saidst but 2 even now.
4, Hal, I told thee 4.
Aye, he said 4.
These 4 came all affront and mainly thrust at me. I made me no more ado, but took all their 7 points in my target thus.
7? Why, there were but 4 even now.
In buckram?
Aye, 4 in buckram suit.
7 by these hilts, or I am a villain else.
Prithee, let him alone. We shall have more anon.
Dost thou hear me, Hal?
Aye, and mark thee too, Jack.
Do so, for it is worth the listening to. These 9 in buckram that I told thee of.
So 2 more already?
Their points being broken.
Down fell their hose.
Began to give me ground, but I followed me close, came in foot in hand, and with a thought, 7 of the 11 I paid.
Ah, monstrous! 11 buckram men grown out of 2.
But as the devil would have it, 3 misbegotten knaves in Kendall Green came at my back and let drive at me, for it was so dark, Hal, thou couldst not see thy hand.
These lies are like the father that begets them, gross as a mountain, open, palpable. Why, thou clay-brained guts, thou knotty-pated fool, thou whore's son, obscene, grease, tallow-cat.
What? Art thou mad? Art thou mad? Is not the truth the truth?
Why, how couldst thou know these men in Kendall Green when it was so dark thou couldst not see thy hand? Come Tell us your reason. What sayest thou to this?
Come, your reason, Jack, your reason.
What? Upon compulsion? Zounds, and I were the strapado of all the racks in the world. I would not tell you upon compulsion. Give you a reason on compulsion? If reasons were as plentiful as blackberries, I would give no man a reason upon compulsion, I.
Thank you. Steepen, the world's thinnest bolster. Now, are there structures in that writing that are still useful to you today?
Yes. I mean, comic? The reason why I chose that bit is essentially that is a comic routine. It's part of a play, but that is a little routine in itself. The exaggerating of the numbers and the constant building of it is a comedy routine, which I'm sure was old when Shakespeare wrote it. I mean, this is clearly not his original joke. He's just done a really, really good version of it, and he's worked it into a play. And I think that's often the case. I can now see, as I couldn't see at school, where it just looks like great dense chunks of text, that very often, I mean, in Twelfth Night, for example, he carefully builds up the premise for a scene, and then the scene plays almost like a sketch. You know, here's a sketch in which someone is dressed as a boy who's a girl and therefore can't reveal that she fancies the person she's talking to because she's supposed to be a man. It's a sketch. And then you have, you know, here is a man who thinks this letter has come from a woman who he's in love with, but actually it hasn't. And he's going to read it out loud, muse about it, and we're going to watch him, and he doesn't know. It's a sketch. You know, it's a comic premise within a play. And the great thing about this is that you don't only get this initial routine of the constant numbers going up and up and up, but you then get, because he's Shakespeare, he then gets to this point where, when it was so dark thou couldst not see thy hand, tell us your reason, what say you to this? Your reason, Jack, your reason. And then the laugh there is for the pause. It's not for the words, it's for the pause, and that's because Shakespeare was an actor. And everything he writes is full of this sense of how things play in performance. It's not just the words. And then brilliantly, of course, at the end there, he turns the routine round by giving this character who has just lied, has just given you this massive series of obvious lies. He's caught out lying, and then he gets himself out of it by actually claiming the moral high ground and saying, well, I don't give people reasons upon compulsion. This is like torture. You know, this is like being on the rack.
Natalie, so, there's a joke in The Frocks about how corny comic porter scenes are,
yes.
Isn't there? Which is, of course, an idea that we're totally familiar with from Shakespeare. So even a joke that was considered corny, a routine that was considered old-fashioned 2,000 years ago, is still alive and well in Elizabethan England.
Absolutely. I think Shakespeare gets much of his comedy inspiration from Plautus, who I hate above almost all writers, having been made to translate him as a sixth former, and he is both rubbish and difficult, two things I don't like. And so loads and loads of those, where you get a long run of people, you get this in A Servant of Two Masters, One Man, Two Governors as well, a long run of somebody explaining something, and the first letter is the same, so somebody's got a whole array of medical conditions, and they all begin with a B or an H or something, that's straight from Plautus, and it's just as annoying there.
In the time we have left, could we take a brief look at more recent work? I mean, are there writers of fiction who have lived more recently who you think stand a chance of surviving the test of time in the way that these pieces have, Steve?
Well, if by recent you mean 20th century,
yeah.
One of the first sort of real out and out comic writers that I was introduced to when I was about 12 was P.G. Wodehouse, who I think as long as English is spoken as a language, I suspect people will read Wodehouse just for the sheer joy of sort of diving in to those words. I mean, my dad gave me this book, not of Jeeves, because that world, you know, is slightly hard if you're 12. He gave me a book of the golf stories called The Clicking of Cuthbert, which is obviously a little bit more accessible. And I was immediately sort of raptured by this extraordinary language where he describes following a foursome of old men on a golf course is following a group of spavined octogenarians rolling peanuts with a toothpick. And and he talks about, there's a wonderful short story in which a Russian novelist called Vladimir Brusilov comes to talk to a book group, basically a 1920s version of the book group. And he describes his books as Vladimir specialised in grey studies of hopeless misery, which I love, and I think that's a very British thing. Is that if you were to ask most people who are the greatest writers in English literature, they would probably say Chaucer, Shakespeare, Jane Austen, Dickens. All of them are comic writers. All of them are people who see those two sides of human life.
Natalie, who would you nominate?
I would have to go for, I guess, Dorothy Parker, since I have started being a critic sometimes myself. Anyone who could dismiss a performance with the words, she ran the gamut of emotions from A to B, will do. And, of course, Fran Lebowitz, who is an amazing writer, hasn't written properly for a long time, but is responsible for one of my favourite jokes of the 20th century when describing herself. Isn't that always the way? Always the godmother, never the god. Yeah.
That's all we have time for, but you were a lovely audience, much better than last week. And to prove it, I'd like you to thank our guests for Radio 3's first ever Comedy Prom Night, Steve Punt and Natalie Haynes.
Matthew Sweet presented this evening's Proms Plus Literary event, and the producer was Dimpfner Flynn. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall with me, Louise Fryer. I'm very lucky to have got a seat at this sell-out event, the BBC Comedy Prom. On-stage host Tim Minchin and his guests will be rejoining the BBC Concert Orchestra shortly for the final set. And the first big number is Reisenstein's Concerto Popolare. It's Reisenstein's centenary this year. The 7th of June would have been his 100th birthday. And young British pianist Danny Driver will be the soloist in the Concerto Popolare, making his proms debut. Quite a way to greet the prommers for the first time. He's a very brave young man. He'll be providing his vocal talents too, as will Sue Perkins and Susan Bullock and Kitten the Widow. And there'll be a chance for more audience participation in one of Flanders and Swann's best love ditties about love springing up between two of the more ungainly creatures to have ever wallowed in the waters of the cool Shalimar. And Beardy Man will be asking for the prommers' help too. He's known as a beatbox virtuoso and will be dazzling our ears with his vocal percussion, to which he somehow manages to add a melody simultaneously. Really quite astonishing to witness. Conductor Andrew Litton will be taking to the podium shortly. At the moment, MD Jules Buckley is standing in front of the BBC Concert Orchestra, ready for part two of this comedy prom.
This is a prom, that we should open the second act with an actual proper classical piece. And I was incredibly excited to learn that two amazing musicians had been booked to do the gig. The pianist, the incredible pianist Danny Driver, and the conductor Andrew Litton are both world-renowned artists working at the very top of their field. It says in my notes that Danny was to play Grieg's famous piano concerto in A minor, but I met the conductor, Andrew, in the loo just during interval, and he was wildly waving his baton about and exclaiming that he was definitely conducting the Tchaikovsky. But either way, please welcome Danny Driver and Andrew Litton.
Thank you.
Leader Cynthia Fleming taking over as Andrew Lytton stormed off in
Johnny
a huff.
Johnny Driver and Andrew Lytton with the famous Concerto Populaire by Franz Reisenstein.
Back to Tim Minchin
Johnny
on stage.
Driver! Andrew Lytton!
Andrew Lytton and Danny Driver seem to have made up, taking a bow at the end there.
Yeah, this is probably not a brilliant idea, getting an actual musician to do an actual piece of music, because I've got to admit to feeling quite insecure now. A little bit defensive, a little bit threatened. And so I think I'm going to do what I've always done in my life, and it served me well, I think, thus far. What I always do when I feel threatened is do something stupid.
I got a box full of stupid people just to support me.
This is a piece I wrote a long time ago. By piece, I mean a stupid thing. By a long time ago. What's this? What is that? Is that Danny's? What is wrong with you? Why does he get his sweat up? He needs to play more. Complete pussy. What's this? All right. Plinky plonky. Oh, lovely. Look at me. Oh, what's this? It's a surrender of your life to practice. I've been having a little problem recently, which is quite disturbing musicalically, involving a semitonal discrepancy vocally and instrumentally. You see, musicians of different varieties prefer playing in particular keys, and singers too treat preferentially those notes they tackle more proficiently. Now, you don't have to be a member of Mensa to understand the depth of my dilemma. The two elements of me favor two different keys, thus the rift betwixt my fingers and my tenor. I like nothing more than playing instruments in F. It warms the very cockles of my heart. The trouble is that F could leave me vocally bereft, you see. I like playing in F major, but I like singing in F sharp, F sharp, F sharp. I refuse to be beholden to my hands. I don't see why my larynx should give in to their demands. I'll not be forced to compromise my art, and so I'll just keep playing in F major and singing in F sharp, F sharp, F sharp. I'll keep playing in F major, but I'll keep singing in F sharp.
You've got to use what skills you've got. Please welcome back to the stage the marvellous Kit and the Widow, Sue Perkins, and the finest Wagnerian soprano of her generation, Miss Susan Bullock.
adorable. We were very, very impressed by your community singing. We were at the end of Act One, yeah. So we thought we'd do it again.
Well,
we?
Sue particularly wants to make sure they're absolutely right for the last night, don't
absolutely.
You?
Yes. Absolutely. You have to be bang on top of it.
Yep. So you have to learn, she learns to ride you like a wave. Now, we are going into falsetto. We are going into falsetto in this number. Do whatever is necessary. Adjust, get your friends. Because we are to go up. But on this Comedy Prom programme, we couldn't possibly not have the greatest comedy song ever.
The most famous ever.
By Flanders and Swan. No. You know exactly what yes. is coming.
Do you know this one, Sue?
I can't sing.
No. You, well,
of course you can sing.
Can you look like a hippopotamus then?
Yes.
Right. Can I sing with you? Could we sing together?
Yes.
That would be nice. It would be very encouraging for me.
It would be a very beautiful moment.
Are you already down
there? We're already,
end?
Yes, we're all
are you
braced.
Ready, Maestro
braced,
Jules?
Yes.
Let's have this hippopotamus song.
Bold hippopotamus was standing one day on the banks of the cool Shalimar.
He gazed at the bottom as it peacefully lay by the light of the evening star.
Away on the hilltop sat combing her hair his fair hippopotamine maid.
The hippopotamus was no ignoramus and sang her this sweet serenade.
Mud, mud, glorious mud, nothing quite like it for cooling the blood. So foe, foe, down to the foe, and let us go in glorious mud.
What a chest.
The fair hippopotamus he aimed to entice from her seat on that hilltop above.
As she hadn't got a ma to give her advice, she came tiptoeing down to her love.
Like thunder the forest re-echoed the sound of the song that they sang as they met.
His inamorata adjusted her garter and lifted her voice in duet.
Falsetto!
Mud, mud, glorious mud, nothing quite like it for cooling the blood. So fully full, down to the hollow, and let us go in glorious
mud. Clara Butt.
Now more hippopotami began to convene on the banks of that river so wide.
I wonder now what am I to say of the scene that ensued on the Shalimar side.
They dived all at once with an ear-splitting splosh. Then rose to the surface again.
A regular army of hippopotami all singing this haunting refrain until they arrive.
Mud, mud, glorious mud,
nothing quite like it for cooling the blood. So
I'm
The Boy with Tape on His Face. And hey. Dimp Minchin. Dimp, you are very good. You are very convincing. I believed in your singing. Is there
you?
Is there nothing you cannot do?
There is no beginning to my talent, is there for sure. Is there?
I mean, you can sing.
You've been done conducting.
You've done conducting.
Bit. You did hippopotamus dancing.
You did hippo dancing.
It's just in the ankles. If anyone wants to repeat this at home, yeah. It's just in the ankles.
Can you prestidigitate?
I beg your pardon.
Is that legal?
I don't think legal in front of this lot.
Don't you play?
A bit.
I know it's not your usual instrument. This is a Steinway. Yeah. Sue normally plays an IKEA.
Yeah.
Do you want to come and do a duet?
Why not?
Oh, why? This would be really fantastic, fun, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
For safety's sake. Come on, Diva.
Let's do this.
It's not safe anymore.
A lovely piece with the band. It's called Dizzy Fingers by Zez Comfrey.
Dizzy Fingers.
I made it. I hit the note. I hit a bottom A. I like hitting bottoms. Most musicians spend years and years training their fingers to do more and more intricate tasks. The next guest spent years and years sitting in his bedroom with a microphone, figuring out how to make stupid noises, which when put together would make the rest of us look pretty boring. He is an oral wizard, a labial legend, a lingual freak. Please put your hands together for my friend, the not very bearded Beardy Man.
Doom, 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 doom.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You're too kind, you're too kind, you're too kind. Ladies and gentlemen,
there is an issue which I wish to address with you all today, and it concerns the canon. By the canon, of course, I don't mean... although that wouldn't be out of place with the problems, but, of course... The canon I'm referring to is the musical canon, that of the entire body of music which we take to be the heredity of our nation. So, with your permission, ladies and gentlemen, I shall now do a certain thing which I've wrote, and it goes a little something like this. Check my lyrics. You see, ladies and gentlemen, all baroque and classical and even the romantic composers oft were prone to dip their quill and then to frantically scribble every detail of their musical ideas on the manuscript before them, spurred in part by fears of being executed by their patron, usually a person with an empire and an army and some horrible perversion, needing music solely for their party or their sermon. Thus composers rarely chose to make experimental versions, which is shocking, really. You know, it all really comes down to the simple fact that their benefactor always backed the dictum of the church, which said that certain chords were evil and all tunes should be inert, and pomp and ceremony went with any brief they were proffered, and many pen paeans to piety and odes to the absurd. But as you see, advances in technology have made it so that any sound conceivable may be facilitated almost instantly, where in the past composers would have waited just for a lifetime to see a new instrument created. Yes, but you see... My lords and ladies and those from the wider gene pool, I must stop this wretched song as it is whack and that means feeble in a language you will never speak because you're all posh people. And if you ask me, I'll tell you that Pachelbel is evil, cause this song is so monotonous and boring and urbane, and it goes on and on and round and round and round and round again, so maddeningly cyclical and sickeningly plain, spiraling into infinity, a black hole in my brain. I do apologise if you were actually enjoying that, ladies and gentlemen. But I wasn't. It was doing my nut. All right, tell you what, here's a little something for you. How about a little bit of this, right? Match, really, isn't it? It's the prongs! You can't do it!
out of the proms. No. Cool. Saints preserve us. Grill me cockles or whatever it is. I don't know. Right, right. Here we go. Here we go. I think this will be a bit more appropriate for the environment. Here it goes. Oh, can somebody give me a concert A, please?
La.
Yes.
It's really true. Can you hear what I'm saying to you? It's like all I want to do right now is tell you all that I don't know how. All I'm doing this in my mind. Yes, if you look closer, you will find I didn't write any of this. It's coming off the top of my head, this. And that's why the next line won't rhyme at all. Cause I...
oh, 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah. I want to tell you that it's been nice playing for you. I gotta go and I adore you now. Say goodbye, and it's the stop, 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 stop. Thank you.
song about prejudice. And the language of prejudice. And the power of the language of prejudice. It's called Prejudice!
Prejudice!
Prejudice! In our modern free-spoken society, there is a word that we still hold taboo,
taboo,
taboo. A word with a terrible history of being used to abuse, oppress and subdue,
subdue.
Just six seemingly harmless letters arranged in a way that will form a word with more power than the pieces of metal that are forged to make swords.
Swords.
Swords. A couple of G's, an R and an E, an I and an N. To six little letters all jumbled together have caused damage that we may never mend. And it's important that we all respect that if these people should happen to choose to reclaim the word as their own, it doesn't mean the rest of you have a right to its use. So never underestimate the power that language imparts. Sticks and stones may break your bones, but words can break hearts. Geez, unless you've had to live it, even I am careful with it. An I and an N, in the end it will only offend. Don't wanna have to spell it out again. Yeah, yeah. Only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. So listen to me, if you care for your health, you won't call me ginger unless you ginger yourself. Only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. When you are a ginger, life is pretty hard. Here's a ritual bullying in the schoolyard. Kids call in your anger and Fanta pants. No invitation to the high school dance. But you get up and learn to hold your head up. You try to keep you cool and not get fed up. But until the feeling of illness truly let up, then the word is as and as alone. Don't you know that only a ginger can call another ginger ginger? Come on, let me hear you say. Only a ginger can call another ginger. Yeah, yeah. So if you call us ginger, we just might come unhinged. If you don't have a fringe with at least a tinge of the ginger, then only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Now listen to me, we're not looking for sympathy just because we're sensitive to UV. Just because we're pathetically pale, we do alright with the females. Yeah, I like to ask the ladies round for ginger beer, and soon they're running their fingers through my ginger beard and dunking my ginger nuts into their ginger tea. Yeah, and asking can they call me ginger, and I say I don't think that's appropriate, cause only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Sing Albert Hall! Only a ginger. And all the ladies, they agree it's a fact. Once you're gone, ginger can't go back. Only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Yeah, go you funky mother! Can call us bozo or fire truck,
fire truck,
fire truck. You can even call us carrot top or blood nut,
blood nut, blood nut, blood.
Yeah, you can call us matchstick or tampon,
tampon,
tampon.
But playing with the G word is just not us. If you're a ginger folk and you don't like us, we will stand up to the fight if you want to fight us. But if you cut yourself, you might catch gingivitis. So maybe you should shut your funky mouth. Only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Sing! Only a ginger can call another. So if you call us ginger, you can't whinge. If you're injured, if you don't have a tinge of the ginger in your minge. Only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. And you know my kids will always be clothed and fed, cause Papa's gonna be bringing home the gingerbread. And they'll be pretty smart because they'll be well read. And by red I mean red and the other kind of red. Woo! Only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Sing! Hey, only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Just like only a ninja can sneak up on another ninja. Only a ninja, only a ninja, only a ninja, yeah. I use a ninja, I'm not pointing the finger, I'm just having a singer, I am just reminding ya. That only a ginger can call another ginger. Ginger.
Friends, is that I hope you've had a wonderful night here at the Proms. I hadn't thought about what I'd say here. Yeah, go nuts. Go nuts! That's Ben on the cello. It's beautiful. Oh, it's gorgeous. Yeah, it's beautiful. The BBC comes to Dorsetshire. Please thank Doc Brown.
Thanks for not stereotyping me too. If you do, I will sell you drugs, then kill you.
Yeah! Sue Perkins!
Nos! Nos!
BBC Three's The Mongrels! The boy with tape on his face!
Queen. Thank you, BBC Concert Orchestra, and please thank all the guests tonight. Sue Perkins, Susan Bullock, Kit the Widow, Danny Driver, Beardy Man, Andrew Linton, the boy with tape on his face, and Doc Brown. Thank you for coming.
And that was Tim Minchin living out his critic's nightmare of a member of the royal family playing the Doctor Who theme on a guitar, wearing a Prince Charles lookalike mask and standing on the piano stool for that final solo. A guitar for the uninitiated, a curious hybrid, a guitar that you play using piano keys rather than strumming the strings. Well, all the comedians and musicians lined up across the front of the stage, and Jules Buckley encouraging the concert orchestra to stand, and everybody's applauding everybody else. Giving a wave as they leave the platform. All sorts of highlights, too many to mention, although I have to say, one of my favorites was seeing the boy with tape on his face playing the timpani during the mud song, the hippopotamus song, only in fact having no timpani at all because he's miming. Jules Buckley is now conducting the audience in their cheers as he indicates the BBC Concert Orchestra with their leader Cynthia Fleming taking a greater role than often she has to, stepping in from time to time to conduct, to play the piano, to redirect the soloist's fingers when Danny Driver was playing the Concerto Popolare. And here comes Tim Minchin back onto the stage and the other performers with him. And greeting Cynthia Fleming with a kiss. He was about to sit back down at the piano, but yes, I think we're going to have a little more.
So I basically saw this concert as an opportunity to force incredible musicians to do what I wanted them to do. And this is probably the most self-indulgent of these forcings. Jules Buckley, he's my private conductor.
There's a force that stops the chaos flooding in. This is my earth, and it's fine. It's where I spend the vast majority of my time. It's not perfect, but it's mine. It's not perfect. This is my house, and I live in it. It's made of cracks and photographs. We bought it from a guy who bought it from a guy who bought it from a guy whose granddad left it to him. Weirdest thing is that this house has locks to keep the baddies out, but they're mostly used to lock ourselves in. This is my house,
majority of my time. It's not perfect, but it's mine. It's not perfect, but it's mine. This is my body. It's 35 and 10 months old. It's changed a lot since it was new. It's done stuff it wasn't built to do. I often try to fill it up with wine. And the weirdest thing about it is I spend so much time hating it, but it never says a bad word about me. This is my body, and it's fine. It's where I spend the vast majority of my time. It's not perfect, but it's mine. It's not perfect. This is my brain, and I live in it. It's made of love and bad song lyrics. It's tucked away behind my eyes, where all my screwed up thoughts can hide. 'Cause God forbid I hurt somebody. And the weirdest thing about a mind is that every answer that you find is the basis of a brand new cliche. This is my brain. It's fine. It's where I spend the vast majority of my time. It's not perfect, but it's mine. It's not perfect, but it's mine.
Perfect. That touching final number rounding off this night of laughs from the Royal Albert Hall. The first ever comedy prom, and with a reception like this, I'm sure it won't be the last. Doc Brown and the boy with tape on his face coming out to join the Heavenly Choir, who were accompanying the Australian Tim Minchin at the piano. The chorus consisting of Sue Perkins, Susan Bullock, Danny Driver, Kit and the Widow, and Beardy Man. And if you feel you missed any of the visual humour, it's on BBC Two, I think, on the 27th of August. So do look out for it. More details, of course, on the Proms website, bbc.co.uk/proms. And tomorrow evening promises to be a touch more sober, with a choral prom recreating an all-Britain concert conducted by Britain himself in 1963. Jiří Bělohlávek will be at the helm of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, with the massed voices of the BBC Singers, the BBC Symphony Chorus and Trinity Boys Choir. Soloists include Amanda Rucroft, Christine Rice, John Mark Ainsley and Christopher Maltman. That's in Britain's Cantata Misericordium, the Sinfonia de Requiem, and also his Spring Symphony. And the evening begins with a new arrangement by Joby Talbot of Purcell's Chaconne. That's tomorrow night at 7, live on Radio 3. But with the BBC Concert Orchestra standing at the end of this BBC Comedy Prom, and everybody, in fact, in the hall on their feet to give a standing ovation, the performers are returning to the stage one more time. Here comes Tim Minchin. And with those cheers for him, I'll hand you on for the rest of this evening's listening to Jill Anderson at Broadcasting House.
Well, thank you very much. That was Louise Fryer at the Royal Albert Hall. And if you'd like to hear that comedy prom again, you can do that by going to the Radio 3 website. Well, coming up at 10:30 here and now, Sarah Moore-Peach presents music inspired by Buddhism and Eastern philosophy, performed by Chroma, music by Rolf Hind, Param Veer and Jonathan Harvey. This evening's edition of The Wire is another chance to hear a fictional drama inspired by the traumatic events at the Admiral Duncan pub in London in 1999. Developed from an award-winning play staged at the Brighton Theatre, the drama is a study of prejudice and extremism, including racism and homophobia, and contains strong language. The playwright, Jonathan Cash, introduces The First Domino.
On Friday the 30th of April 1999, I was standing in a pub in Soho called the Admiral Duncan, and a nail bomb exploded about 6 feet away from me. The First Domino is based on my experience of surviving the Admiral Duncan, but it's about a fictional terrorist and a fictional psychiatrist. Having gone through something like that, you think very differently about everything, and I realised that everybody has a part to play, in a way. I think The First Domino is about misconceptions and looking at the ways that people accept intolerance. We misconceive people all the time, everybody does. And in the play, I realised that the terrorist has misconceptions about minority groups, and the doctor has misconceptions about the terrorist, and we have misconceptions about everybody. What do we expect a terrorist to be like? What would it be like if a terrorist was actually quite charming or vulnerable? Whenever anybody derides somebody else with hurtful words, they create a landscape in which it's acceptable to hate.
Your Auntie Sandra sends her love. I said, didn't I? She came out before she went in again. She collapsed during the accumulator. I don't go. I'm coming backwards and forwards from here. 800 miles a month I'll be doing. Are you all right? Andrew.
What?
Your face looks different.
What are you on about?
What are they giving you?
Same as before.
You need to eat more. I was going to bring you some more damson, but I don't think you like that one. Your eyes gave it away.
Sociopathy and Offender Management. Chapter 1. Dynamics and Influences.
Your father's grown some apricots.
How's he?
I think he's got an allotment. I know he applied. He said he wanted to be nurturing.
Nurturing?
I think they're apricots. I just make jam out of them.
What's this one like, then?
I don't know. I haven't had any. Do you want some, then? I brought it with me. In plastic containers, like the man said. Well, don't bite me hand off. Some for your new friend and all.
Thanks, he'll be thrilled.
What's his name again? A GP, you said?
Martin.
Oh. Well, give some to him, then. Is he, is he all right?
Yeah. Quietly spoken.
Well, he's a GP. They're trained. You will rinse them out, won't you, so I can have them back? What's he in for?
had a fight with his wife.
I don't like violent men.
You could be really hurtful sometimes.
Do you want your dad's magazines bringing? Might take your mind off.
Very kind. But I don't really see the point of reading 12 separate editions of How to Build a Ship in a Bottle, on accounts of how he's taken all the bits that comes with How to Build a Ship in a Bottle, built the entire ship, constructed the actual bottle, and rendered the plastic frames it all snapped out of, and the very magazine itself entirely redundant.
I wish you wouldn't talk like that. There's no need. Do you want this jam or not?
He's here, transferred from Langton.
And?
With your permission, Dr. Briley, I'd like to interview him in support of my paper.
Remind me, title?
Sociopathy and Offender Management. I'm due to speak in Stockholm in the new year.
Don't develop the syndrome.
Sorry?
Don't apologise. You'll need a sense of humour with this one. He's very sharp.
How sharp?
I'm sure you'll find him useful. But remember, don't show how you feel. We're very glad to have you here. Quite a coup.
Thank you, Dr. Briley.
But don't get above your station. It's the only coup you'll be involved in.
Hello, Andrew. I'm Dr. Johnson.
How literary.
Don't start. I've had that since I was little.
Tribe called Davis. Betty.
Right. I hate nicknames. Thanks for doing this.
Did you have one when you were a kid? A nickname?
Andrew, I can't offer personal information.
Oh, you're not offering. I'm demanding.
Yes, I was told.
What?
Okay, well, when I was a kid, I was always good at English, so they called me Dictionary.
Christ, you went to a rough school.
And you can imagine what Dictionary was shortened to.
No.
But if you don't call me that, I won't call you...
Fair enough.
Call me Mike. So, how are you settling in?
Better than the last place. But I want to speak to a manager.
You can speak to me. What's the matter?
When I got here, they didn't leave chocolates on the pillow or turn down the beds. Perhaps you could have a word?
I was told you have a keen sense of humour.
Got to, haven't you? Otherwise you'd go mad.
It's a good coping strategy.
You brought anything?
Like what?
Something to sweeten me up. Tobacco. Papers. Because if you want me to open up to you week after week, might be an idea.
You don't have to.
Oh, come on. I only get homemade jam. I've got a stash the size of a small emerging continent.
Okay.
They took your Auntie Linda up the infirmary.
I don't care.
Maybe I can arrange something.
She was in shock. I had to fetch her slippers for her.
What do you want?
Silly bitch.
Silly bitch. Andrew?
Couple of hundred B&H.
But I don't think you'll be allowed that many.
Oh, they won't care. It's not a normal prison. It's different when the keys have been chucked away.
What does that feel like?
Give us 200 fags and I'll tell you. And some tobacco. Golden Prairie. Blue packet, not red.
Fine. So, what does it feel like?
And some papers. Licorice.
Anything else?
Probably. I'll sleep on it.
Sleeping well?
You will bring them, won't you?
I'll see what I can...
Because you've got to keep me sweet. I'm not doing it for nothing. Know what I mean?
Of course. So how
are you? So, yeah, I'm all right. Couldn't sleep when I first got here. I kept waking up with the noise. There was a nutter down the corridor, kept banging about like a right... well, nutter. Kept shouting about turbines at 3 a.m. But he hanged himself, so it's all right now. Was that an official question? About sleeping?
Yes, if you like.
Did you think I weren't sleeping because of guilt? It's a bit clichéd, isn't it?
How long have you been here now?
8 days.
And how are you adjusting?
Who cares? I'm here till I leave in a box, unless they move me again.
Is that difficult to think about?
No. What am I giving up? Crap job? Bedsit? Food's all right. Better than I can do.
So who are you getting to know?
Excuse me?
Anyone you get along well with.
I've only been here 2 minutes. Most of them are barking. There's one guy called Phil or Frank or something. He keeps asking me to play cards with him, but I keep winning. Because he's mental.
Anyone else?
Well, there's one bloke. Head like a bulldog. He's pretty normal. Martin, GP. Cut up his wife and ate part of her tits. I don't win with him all the time, so he's all right.
You like intelligent people.
Well, I'm not exactly Einstein, but I just get on better with people who don't bring themselves off over your pie and chips. I'm a bit more in control. Know what I mean?
Hey, the police. Emergency services have just arrived.
What's your name, darling?
The whole street.
What's your name?
Smoke. And we all just like, what?
Mum, you have to keep talking.
And I've seen personally about a dozen, I guess, people lying, some of them very badly injured.
Chapter 2. Establishing trust.
Hello, Martin.
Oh, Doctor.
How's Andrew doing?
Fine. Why?
Oh, just asking. Is he settling in?
Oh, you're the doctor.
Well, from one to another. Just wondered.
Well, no problems, as far as I know. While you've got me here, I meant to ask, can you see what you can do about the new activity times? I prefer that sort of thing on a Monday, you know, after the weekend. We like routine here, Doctor. And they've changed the television times. I miss things.
Well, I'll see what I can do. Let me know what programmes you want to watch.
I love that sitcom with Judi Dench.
OK, as it's you. Where is Andrew, by the way?
He has a job now, in the library.
Oh, this is where you're hiding.
Gets me out of football.
Oh, I thought you'd like that.
Not into groups. More of a solo artist, me. There's only so much I can stand listening to someone bang on about their wives and kids. My little Tommy said the word tractor the other day. Oh, did he really? I said the word infanticide. Do you give a shit?
Thanks for talking with me last week. Don't you want to continue?
Who else did you ask?
Sorry, I can't say. But I think you're the most interesting.
Why?
Most of the others have only killed once.
So my collection of stiffs are finally worth something.
It's more a case of what you actually did and why.
You see, I asked you to bring me some fags and stuff, but they weren't exactly forthcoming.
Look, talk to me. I promise, I'll sort you out.
People have promised me all my life.
200, yes?
Promise?
Yes. I promise.
Chapter 3. Cultural influences.
Andrew, do you think that killing people was controlled?
Well, I didn't just happen to have bombs in my hand.
Most people express anger in less extreme ways.
So? Diminished responsibility, my lawyer said. If anyone died, it was only a byproduct.
A byproduct? Funny, the impressions you form about people. From what I'd read, I imagined you weren't very articulate.
Thanks. From what I'd read, I imagined you'd gone to the rank school of charm.
Your cultural references are surprising.
Well, it's my mum. She's ancient. Dad's her toy boy. She loves old films. I know all that stuff. Robert Mitchum, Grace Kelly. I watched loads of films growing up. Cheaper than a babysitter, innit? Anyway, I'm more intelligent than the retards in here. Bunch of freaks. The stiffs I'm in here for were just byproducts. All right?
So, what did you intend to do? Damage buildings?
Listen, getting off my arse and doing it made a statement. Most people only think about it.
About what?
Killing scum.
You killed a pregnant woman.
I'll tell you what, next time I'll ask them first if anyone's up the duff.
Do you want there to be a next time?
Maybe.
How?
Bigger. A shop or whatever. A big van.
You drive a van into a shop?
No. Leave it outside. I'm not a suicide bomber. They're seriously screwed. Not exactly given the bigger picture, are they?
And you? Do you think about people you hurt? What do you think of the baby who was injured?
Not a lot. It was black.
He had a 4-inch nail in his head.
Ah. Fab picture on the front of the Standard, though. X-ray of its head with a nail through it.
You don't feel any remorse?
Well, does it look like it? Listen, if you want to ask questions about how someone feels, go and skip off with your touchy-feely mates.
What about yours? Any mates come to see you? I hear your mother visits.
Oh, here we go. It's all her fault.
You don't have to tell me what you think I should hear. I'm not a social worker.
Oh, that's a shame. I thought I might get a bigger council house out of it.
Do you want to talk about your mum, Andrew?
Sure you're not a social worker, dictionary?
We agreed you wouldn't call me that.
Tell me about her. I'm interested.
I had a terrible childhood, okay? I was abused. Even on my 17th birthday, I wanted a pony, and they only got me a Ford Escort. Well, what did you think I was going to say?
What do you want that for? Wanting to be nurturing?
She loves me.
I said to him, if you want to be nurturing, you should
come. Do you love her?
See our Linda.
She comes in.
The infirmary.
We don't talk about it, you know, what I did. We don't talk about anything much.
She's younger than me.
She goes on about whatever she's been doing. New curtains.
Poor Linda.
Lovely piece of haddock. Some auntie that's not even related.
Kicking around with vegetables.
I nod and say yes and no in the wrong places.
Do you want some jam?
Do you want to talk about your father? Isn't that your next question? No. I don't know him and he doesn't know me. There, the end. How long have you been doing this?
Why?
What's it like?
Rewarding.
Do you feel in control? Been to college? Didn't they show you how to use a dictaphone? You haven't switched it on.
Chapter 4. Family background.
Can I take my shoes off?
Sure.
Oh, I forgot what carpet feels like. Nice place, Dr. Head Shrink. You like certificates, then? I want to do a physics degree, me. You can get them through the post. I can get a job at CERN, then, smashing hadrons together.
So, what do you want to talk about?
Lots of things.
Like, how do you make a bomb?
Maybe. But I want to know about you. What makes you tick?
Talk. Bang.
Your sense of humour interests me.
Thank you very much.
Okay. What makes you laugh?
I like jokes. Here's one. A priest walks by this river and he sees a little girl crying. He says, "Hello, little girl. What's wrong?" She says, "It's my mummy and daddy. We were in the car at the edge of the river and I got out to pick some flowers. When I looked back to wave at them, the car rolled down and fell off the edge into the river with mummy and daddy inside it, and now they're dead." The priest says, "Oh dear, not your lucky day, is it?"
Put it away, Andrew. I take it you're not religious, then.
What's black and red and spins round? A wog in a liquidizer. No?
Would you be uncomfortable if I was religious?
No, I'd just laugh.
What if I was black? Or gay?
I don't think it would be me who was uncomfortable, mate.
Maybe. But if I was, and I met you...
I'd kick your teeth in. Unless I didn't know. You might not let on, you know, that you were, black. No, only kidding, I'd kneecap you.
Why?
Because you're a black puff so far.
What are your family's views about ethnic minorities?
Well, you just say stuff, you know, about wogs and puffs. People do, you tell jokes.
Weren't there any Asian kids at school?
Bloody hundreds.
Hundreds?
Yeah, even had their own class. And white teachers, right? White. They had to learn Guja Chapati or whatever it is. What's that about? I went to sign on once and they'd spent money on leaflets for them. It's not right. They come here, they should learn English.
You didn't get to know any of the Asian lads at school.
What for? I don't want to get to know any in here either.
How would you feel if someone didn't want to get to know you?
I wouldn't care.
But if you don't get respect, that irritates you.
More than friggin' irritates me.
Exactly. Everybody should have respect.
Do you like everyone you meet?
Not everyone.
So we agree then?
But if I met someone I didn't like, I'd still be civil to them.
Daddy brought you up to be civil, did he?
I was brought up to treat people with respect.
Well, that's where Daddy went wrong. Because there are people like me out there who aren't as naive as your Daddy.
Andrew, sit down.
Middle-class ponce.
Tell me about Carousel.
What did you say?
He mentioned it in the trial. Ever seen it?
Mum did.
So?
That song in it. You're a Queer One, Julie Jordan.
And?
She used to sing it.
It's just a song. Rodgers and Hammerstein, isn't it?
She knew it would wind me up because I couldn't get a girlfriend.
You're a queer one, Julie Jordan. You acquired her in deep
deeper than a well. And you never...
But you went out with girls, didn't you? Eventually?
Eventually.
So what was the problem?
You're a queer one, Julie Jordan. You won't ever tell a body what you think.
Do you know how it feels to walk into a pub and see your brother and his mates snogging loads of girls, turning round and singing, "You're a queer one"? No, I don't. I'm straight, right? It wouldn't bother everyone. I'm not everyone!
I'm very disappointed in your performance.
Please don't be. These things take time.
You didn't go to Stockholm.
I was ill.
I'm worried that you can't deliver.
You don't have anything to worry about.
No? You've been here 2 minutes. You persuade me to let you spend time away from your core duties by promising us kudos and glory for a paper that you're presenting at a conference, and you don't go.
You know, I was ill. I had to cancel. I couldn't travel.
Do you know how embarrassing this is?
I'm sorry.
What have you done so far?
I need to win his trust properly and dig deeper.
What have you done so far?
A basic profile. But building trust takes time.
You're telling me.
I'm encouraging him to write things down. Weekly exercises. How he feels about certain issues.
Fitting in. What do I know about that?
It'll stretch your imagination. And in summer, you can read it out at the presentations.
Yeah, right.
It'll help you think about other people.
I do. They're twats.
It's designed to put you in someone else's shoes. It helps a lot of people. Well, the intelligent ones.
Something to do.
Excellent. Want to read out this one?
Okay. Respect.
Announce it.
What?
Come on. Respect.
I'm not deaf.
It's the title. Announce it. Respect. Everyone at the back has to be able to hear it.
Back of what? Poland?
Respect is what you want other people to give you. Come on, read it out.
If I'd have been taught more respect when I was at school, my life would have been different.
Would have.
Would have. There is some rules...
Ah, come on. There are some rules that you find out for yourself without...
Without nobody telling you, but you learn from mistakes, I suppose. But I never took notice of people I should have...
Come on. Do it properly.
I've hated people all my life. I let it all out and now I'm here. They reckon I won't get out till I'm 90. What do they know? Prison's like society because it's built on a system. Some think it's unfair, but as Charles Darwin called it, natural selection. Survival of the fittest. The strongest ones win. I made that up.
It's not about who's stronger, though, is it, Andrew?
Isn't it?
Good morning.
What's up, Doc?
Mum's Sunday call.
Yeah, can't wait.
Nice jam. How is she?
Up and down. Someone keeps putting crap for her letterbox.
Well, like what?
Crap.
Oh, dogs.
No, humans.
Oh, nice. Are you okay?
Yeah. Here, you know that guy who's writing this thing?
Yeah. What, still cozying up to him, are you?
Yeah. Yeah, quite a lot. I called him a ponce the other day. Should have seen his face. You know what?
What?
I think he's a gay boy.
Chapter 5, Belief Systems.
Let's get to know each other. Mike?
Sorry?
Because I'm supposed to trust you. Open up. But you don't do it in return.
I'm a member of staff.
One rule for you.
Andrew?
Because you either trust me or you don't.
OK. I trust you.
Right, so tell me something about you. Where do you live?
Near here.
Where?
We can't say, I'm afraid.
What do you do to relax?
I listen to music.
Why did they move you from Oakwood?
They didn't move me.
Not what I heard.
What?
I heard you were fiddling about with the mentals.
I beg your pardon?
Is it true?
Think about it. If that was true, I wouldn't have been able to get a job elsewhere, would I? So no, it's not true. Stop playing games. Come on, back to the exercise.
Tried seeing what it feels like to be in other people's shoes.
To examine your actions, reactions.
Most people wouldn't have my reactions. All the bollocks. Not till me.
Go on.
What I did encouraged other people. Do the same. A domino effect. Me first, then others go. One by one.
Why did you plant the bombs?
I knew it'd hack people off.
You just wanted to hack someone off?
Why shouldn't I?
You could have smashed a window.
I'm not 10. Look, these exercises are great, but you won't change me by getting me to write bollocks about respect or fitting in.
I can ask you to challenge your beliefs.
I don't want my beliefs challenged. It's not like I'm getting out, is it? I just don't like people. No great science to it. Some people just don't.
Don't you want to learn?
You mean change. Why can't you leave people alone?
Why didn't you?
Because they disgust me.
And that's respect.
It's what I know. And if the pigs didn't get me, it would have been Tottenham, Southall, wipe them all out.
What have these people done to you, these communities?
Communities? You don't hear anyone talking about a white community. What's it mean, anyway? The Asian community. What? They all go round Mrs. Gupta's house on a Friday night and cook onion bhajis. There's no such thing as a community, nowhere. You know what made me laugh? It was in the papers. Some packy woman's lying on a mortuary slab in Cricklewood, right? And someone, for a laugh, puts a bit of bacon on her corpse. Now, because she's touched a forbidden food, all her stupid family are in despair because they think she's burning in hell because they believe everything they're taught and never question it. Good old communities.
Religion is a great comfort to millions of people.
Do you ever speak normally, Dr. Cliché? Think for yourself. You're as bad as they are.
I'm trying to be objective. That's the point of our exercises.
Our exercises. You love them, don't you? The caring professions. Put your head on one side of your shoulder and look really, really concerned. And repeat after me. So how do you feel? And how much do you get paid?
I'm sensing frustration.
There! You can't help yourself, can you? Stop repeating all that shit. Do you really think it works?
I think we know what we're talking about, Andrew. The caring professions have been around a long time.
So is religion and cancer. You know what? When I blew up that market, some starry-eyed geezer with a long beard on telly was saying that whoever did it, me, as it happens, when I die, I'll be in hell forever, having boiling water poured over my head. Well, when I'm there, mate, I'll give your best wishes to Granny Piggin Gupta. Fire and water in the same place, apparently. Oh, well, at least I'll have bacon. So shove your bargees up your arse, mate. Never questioning
Andrew,
anything.
Andrew, try to control your temper.
Why should some god botherer tell me what to think? Prats in hats, the lot of them. I should wear a
Andrew.
Hat. They're all nut-nuts, doing mentally ill things to avoid some made-up hell. It's not even in scripture. Well, it is now. They've put it in. Have you seen them? 80-year-old arthritic women crawling on their hands and knees from Naples to Rome to kiss some Nazi offspring's million-pound ring, and you don't think that's mentally ill? I'd do churches next time. At least I've stood up for us and done something.
You killed people.
What's the difference between me and the church? We both want to see gay boys burn. I use bombs. They use books. Same thing. And no one locks up bishops.
They're not harming people.
Oh, aren't they? At least I got people to think. They were like sheep before I came along. Amen.
I'm sensing a lot of anger.
I'm sensing fear. At least the church is right about you. People like you should be put to death.
What?
You're a social degenerate.
Someone might say the same thing about you.
But you're gay.
So?
I knew it! You'll burn in hell! How did you get in
Sit
here?
Sit down, Andrew.
What are they playing at? I want to see Dr. Brierley.
You're making assumptions.
You just admitted it.
Andrew, sit down. Do you want a cigarette?
If you're queer, I'm going to snap your spine.
If you attempt to be violent, you're in solitary.
They wouldn't have let you in if they knew you were a gay boy.
If I press this button, you're in solitary with no privileges for a month.
I can't believe this. They send me a faggot. What next? They're going to send Rose West a fucking orphan. Is this a wind-up or what? Do they know you're queer?
I think you're making assumptions.
You're scum.
Right. Get off me.
I kill your kind.
David.
Six grams of zip to tramp.
Get
his arms. Now!
Hold it down.
You freak!
She wants to know if you like the jam.
What are they giving you?
Something to
calm my head down.
You can't even sit up properly.
So, did you?
What?
Did you like it?
Oh, Christ, yeah, yeah, it's very nice. Oh, do thank her.
You like eating well, don't you?
I'm a gourmand. Oh, come on, you haven't moved in ages. Oh,
give me a minute.
We won't finish till you get out at this rate.
I'm thinking.
Making a lot of noise. Now, come on, Space Cadet. I wouldn't do that.
Who are you? The chess police?
I'll take your bishop.
Yeah, they're all like that.
You'll lose.
You'll lose?
I wouldn't go there either. It'll be checkmate in 5 moves.
I'm resigning. You win.
Put up a fight, you big wuss. You could still win.
My head hurts. I want a hat.
What else are you going to do?
Gardening.
Oh, yeah, your little piece of heaven. How did you get that, anyway?
When David Frost let me out of solitary, I just asked him for it. I can get what I want now. I got him to admit that he's queer. And if they find out, he's had it.
Are you serious?
Yeah, yeah. He's got to keep me sweet, hasn't he?
Absolutely sure.
Not 100%, but there's something there.
Why, has he... No.
Just little things.
Like what?
I don't know, he's just...
Well, is this one of your things about people?
Shove a bishop up your arse.
Not my bag, I'm afraid. I'm a breast man.
So am I, but not in a bag next to the frozen peas 3 weeks after it died.
Shut up. Run along. Give him a tantalising glimpse.
What are you on about?
You know where his office is, don't you? Third floor, next to the admin offices, overlooking a certain little garden next to the bins.
Andrew?
I want a cigarette. Here.
Andrew, what's the matter? What's wrong?
Everyone knows a secret freak. Everyone.
Who's upset you?
What's interesting about freaks is that sometimes it's the ones that you least expect that are the freakiest.
What's happened?
Take a tip, mate. Show a little respect. Or you'll hack me off. Know what I'm saying?
Chapter 6. Isolating the prisoner.
You look rested. That's nice.
Must be the new stuff.
Andrew, do you like it here?
Yeah. Not bad. You get to do different stuff.
Oh, good. That's good. That's what Dr. Johnson said.
Got my job in the library.
It's nearly 3 o'clock.
Oh, yeah, but we'll bugger off then.
Andrew.
Well, thanks for making the effort.
I have tried. It takes ages to...
You all right?
Yeah, of course I am.
Of course.